This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
What we had to do this morning, I wonder what with Joanne, because it's something she asked about. You haven't seen her around, have you, Joanne? Should we distant? Although she normally, if she's not here, she's probably got something on.
No, let me check it out.
Because we're dealing with stuff that she raised. Who would have thought that Lot and his daughters would have led us on such a ramble? What we wanted to raise was the, having established these three approaches, the Rambam and the Ramban and the Sefer HaChinuch, and I'll summarize them very briefly, we wanted to look at modern trends in Judaism and see where everything fits in, and then get back to one or two issues on Lot and his daughters before we leave them today. The three views in that we had was, all three views were based on the fact that God has given us infinite choice, and that true expression of our affiliation to Him comes through making choices for Him, not through being compelled to have to do so. And so He gave us opportunities and left us freedom. And opportunity and freedom are the two requirements for choice. If there's no opportunity, there's no choice. If there's no freedom to choose, there's no choice. There has to be opportunity, there has to be choice. And in fact, the more you increase opportunity, the more you're increasing choice. The more you're increasing freedom, the more you're increasing choice. So if we're going to say that choice is good and that choosing God is good, then the more opportunity you have to choose other things, the greater is the value of the choice of God. And that's why God gave us so much opportunity in this world. That's why there's so much here. And that leads into the Mesillas Yesharim's opening statements that everything in the world is a test. And that doesn't mean like the Christian sense of everything is there to distract us. But he says wealth is a test and poverty is a test. Don't think you escape the test by being poor. You've got different tests if you're poor. And if being clever is a test and being stupid is a test. And being beautiful is a test and being ugly is a test. Now, whatever you are, you're in a position where you have a lot of choices to make and a lot of different ways to respond. And God puts us here to give us the opportunity to make those choices, each person in their own situation. How to relate to the material world is where these three divergent views, where these three views diverge. The view of the Ramban, we learned, was that they're almost irreconcilable. That matter and spirituality are like water and air. The one goes in, the other goes out. The more materialism you have, the less spirituality you have. And therefore, each person has to find his level that he can most comfortably operate at, but the ideal is to limit the material to the minimum. Because the more matter there is, the less spirit there is. That's the Ramban's view. And the Ramban himself, although he doesn't necessarily impose it on other people, takes that very far and says, for example, even in areas, certainly in areas of business and so on, one must spend very little time in going after that, because God can make that. If you're doing the right thing spiritually, you don't have to worry an awful lot about the physical things, the material things. God will make good. And he, in fact, goes so far as to say, you remember even that he himself would not call doctors in. And the Vilna Gaon followed a similar route for himself and his family. He didn't impose on other people, but for himself and his family. He got quite angry when he went to visit his brother who was ill, and there was a doctor there. And he said, since when does our family call doctors? What do we need doctors for? We've got, if we're doing things right spiritually, then sooner or later Hashem will make, worried about you.
Excuse me.
That's okay. Then sooner or later God will take care of it and you don't have to worry. That's the Ramban's view. Now, as extreme as that view is, one has to realize the the correctness of it in the ideal and in the absolute, and realizing the correctness, you'll understand, is going to be an important part of this morning's discussion. The Ramban's part.
I haven't gone
to the Ramban. But for you, the Ramban might be more important to hear. The Ramban, you know well. the legitimacy of that lies, if you look even in the material world, if you look where science is going, where is science going? Less matter, more spirit. David Medved was telling me on Shabbos, he was the pioneer of saying, we don't really need cables to transmit information, we can transmit information down a light beam. And all you need then is fiberglass to get the light beams around corners. So he pioneered fiber optics, which means do away with the cable, do away with the matter. You can transmit information without the copper cables. Now he's onto something else. Who needs the fiber? Who needs the fiberglass? Why can't you just use light? So he is now transmitting information down a light beam with no matter at all. Nothing. There's no wire, there's no cable, there's nothing. And to me that is so exciting, because it's the ultimate of, if you look at the whole diminishment of the role that matter has been playing in our products, it's quite astonishing. If you go to your old washing machines, it was all just brute force, these big things that used to go around and a little motor that used to drive it. It was a big chunk of iron. You go to it now, 90% of what you're paying for is a little computer chip inside that makes the whole thing work. In your microwave oven, not a big furnace over there with massive amounts of electricity being converted into heat, slowly burning and eventually heating your food up. Turn it on in a few seconds, it's there, because you're working with intellect, you're working with spirit, you're not working with matter. Open a computer, what is there? There's sand. The only matter in a computer that's a plastic is not important. There's a little bit of cable, milligrams of it, and the rest is sand. And intellect. And wisdom. And what's a human being? What did God make the human being out of? Out of sand and wisdom. It's quite amazing how we're not using matter anymore. We're using wisdom. We're using spirit to drive the world. And they do go hand in hand. As you reduce the matter, the more there's spirit. As you have more spirit, there's less need for matter. So we see it happening in the physical world. We see it happening in the scientific world. And the Ramban's view is the same as in the spiritual world. The more spirit, true spirit you have, genuine spirit, not fake stuff, the more true spirit you've got, the less physical you need. A person who is spiritually fulfilled in the true sense needs to eat less. A person who is spiritually fulfilled in the true sense needs less with which to cope. His fulfillment comes from other things, so that his dependence on physical things for fulfillment is less. And that is true. The only question is it realistic for the average person to be able to be involved in true, pure spirituality to such an extent that he doesn't become a small person, that he is as rich and as varied and as excited without the physical, because he's getting it all from the spiritual. The Ramban's option is not become a little nebuch, become a little nobody. The Ramban says you've got to be just as that little computer can do more than the big old computers that used to occupy the floor of a building this size, and now your little laptop can do more than that. It's not get small and do less. It's get small physically and do more, because you are spiritually so powerful. And one has to question whether that's realistic for our generation, for our kind of people. So then we come to the... And therefore the Ramban says, if we get back to the Nozir story, that's why the Nozir brings a sacrifice at the end of his period, because having been living that way for 30 days, he's now going back into the physical world, which he has to do. So he is acknowledging that God says to the Nazir, don't stay there longer than 30 days, you won't make it. It's ideal, but it's not practical. So get back into the physical world. And because it's ideal but not practical, I'm telling you to get back into the physical world, but bring a sacrifice. Those of you who are sure on Shabbos, Rabbi Pesach touched on a similar idea where he gave examples of where sometimes the halakha tells you to do things and tells you at the same time to apologize for doing them. Not everything that you have to do is the ideal. Sometimes it's just the practical. So he gave the example of sometimes you have to fast on Shabbos and then fast the next day because you fasted on Shabbos. So sometimes the halakha requires us to do things which are not ideal, and therefore we have to make amends for doing things even though the halakha said we had to do them. So with a nazir, the Torah is saying, stop it after a month because you won't be able to live on that level. But bring a sacrifice so that you realize that you've come down from where you were. And you had to come down from where you were, but you've come down. You've got to realize where you are as a lower level than where you were, but as the right place for you to be. And that's a very important concept if we're going to go the Ramban's way. That you can deal with an ideal model, but you need to know that that ideal model might not be right for you. It might have been right for the Ramban as an individual, it might have been right for the Vilna Gaon and for his brother as individuals, but it's not right for you and me. So then we have the Chinuch's view, the Sefer Chinuch's view, which is what the Nazir did was good, but maybe he went too far, and therefore he brings a korban. Does he know exactly how much matter to cut out? And if you cut out too much matter, it's just as bad as bringing in too much matter. So you're walking with narrow balance, and he has to bring a sacrifice because maybe he went to the extreme. He was too hard on himself. And then we get the Ramban's view, the Ramban's view, with its typical carriage, where he says nonsense. He says anything the Torah doesn't want you to be involved in, the Torah tells us. The Torah is not shy to say don't do this and don't do that. So we've got quite a comprehensive list of the things we're not supposed to be engaged in. But that means anything else is okay. God didn't put us here to distract us. Everything else and anything else is okay to be engaged in. All that we've got to do is get the proportions right and use it in the correct way and do the right things with it. But there's nothing in the world that the Torah didn't prohibit which is meant to be outside of our area of engagement. Then why does the Nazir have to bring a sacrifice, says the Ramban? Because he became a Nazir. Because for 30 days he wasn't doing that. So you see how the Rambam now is 180 degrees away from the Ramban. The reason he brings a sin offering now is now in apology for having withdrawn from the world more than the Torah considers necessary. And that's not acceptable. But again, as the Ramban says, but that opposite, the Ramban says he's got to go back to the world, but he's got to bring an apology for sacrifice. The Ramban says he may become a Nazir, the Torah gives him full permission to do so, but if you do, you bring a sacrifice afterwards. Again, certain things we're allowed to do, or sometimes even have to do, even though they're not ideal. But for us in that particular state, they're right. So now let's look at modern religious Jewry. Let's look at one can look at all sorts of movements. We'll just see how many of them we go through. But what we want to really look is at the contemporary scene. In the contemporary scene, if we look at the full spectrum, I would say we've got starting at the extreme left, assimilated, reform, conservative, and of course reform is a wide range and conservative is a wide spectrum. I think it's quite oversimplifying with any of these groups to think of conservative reform. There are certain basic similarities across the spectrum, but they're very wide spectrums. Conservative perhaps the widest of them. So you've got assimilated, reform, conservative, modern orthodox, yeshiva orthodox, Hasidish, and me. let's have a look at them and let's try and understand them. And for this, for the purpose of this discussion, we can put conservative and reform in one grouping and assimilated in one grouping. Why can we do that? What's the common denominator? Only for this discussion. There are many other discussions in which one cannot put them in the same grouping at all. But for the purpose of this discussion, we can put them in the same grouping. Well, in that they are, each of them have modified halakha for reasons that they believe are justified to survive, and we won't make it, particularly if you go back into the times that they started doing it, reform into the early 19th century, conservative in the United States, early 20th century, and mid 20th century, times when things were looking pretty bleak and black. One has to realize when they started developing these philosophies. There was a time in Germany there was a bleakness. Do you know how many Jews there were in the world when reform started? In the entire world?
Yeah.
There were less than 2 million in the entire world when reform started. Yeah.
Where were they?
They were scattered over Europe mainly, and some in the Arab countries. There were very, very few, and there was a massive increase in population between
the
nine.
Why it started?
Well, that certainly the threat, the sense that we're depleting, we're disappearing, we're okay, something's going wrong. But that doesn't justify the start of it. But certainly, you've got to realize that that's the environment in which it started, and a sense that we can't live on our own. We're too small a nation to live independently. We've got to integrate if we're going to survive. So that was one of the things that drove it. All sorts of things drove it. But certainly again in the United States during the first part of the century, and again in 1945, there was a feeling of total gloom that there will not be a Jewish people the way it used to be. And there wasn't a sense. One has to be able to try and picture what life felt like for Jews who survived in 1946 and 1947 and 1948. The sense was, it's over. There's no way that we can reestablish what used to be. There were no libraries, there were no printing presses, there were no yeshivas, there were no rabbonim. What was there? A couple of individuals, there was nothing. So there was a sense of enormous gloom. And their view was, if we're going to insist on all the old-fashioned stuff, people are going to leave us. They're just going to drop off. So we've got to modify. And then you develop a whole philosophy to justify that. Well, then the Torah isn't really from God, and it's man-made, and it's different degrees of man-made, and is there a God altogether? Then you've just got different degrees of compromise. And that leads you off to somewhere between a fairly traditional conservatism through to assimilation. It just depends how far you want to take that compromise. The Orthodox view is there are certain things we won't compromise. That Torah is from God, that God exists, that the Torah is God's view and God's word, that is not compromised. Now comes the big question, what about the rabbis? What was their role and what's their authority? What is the Gemara? What kind of authority does that have? Now, to say that we don't compromise on God and the Torah coming from God, there's some conservative groups that accept that. The right wing of the conservative accepts that. To start saying that the Gemara has limited authority, certainly all of conservative would go that way, and the beginning of modern Orthodox starts to go that way. What is the Gemara and what is its authority? The Ramban gives us a clear example of an ideal that might not be workable, and therefore the Nozir has to go back into the real world and bring a sacrifice for doing so. So we see a gap between the model and the real world. God has created an ideal model, but he's created a world that doesn't actually fit the model. And we won't go into the whole question of whether God created that world or we did, whether that was the result of Adam taking his decision to eat and Eve taking a decision. Had they not done that, then there would have been complete congruence between the real world and the Torah's model. Adam's decision was to separate them, to say that's a model, the real world is separate, man's task is to try and align them. We're going to bring the whole world with us, and then we can do it. The question is, if the world is still here, and the model is here, what does the individual do? Does the individual live here, or does he live there? Or does he flip somewhere in between? What is he meant to do? The Rambam's view clearly is, he's meant to bring the world a little closer. And even if in his lifetime he only manages to bring it 1 millimeter closer, that's a lot closer, because that's a lot of people coming closer. The Ramban's view almost is, well, if you as an individual can jump, then that's the best thing that you can do. Leave the world and jump into the model. But if you can't, then you sort of oscillate, spend a month as a nazir and go back and in and out, and at least experience the model, so that when you're back in this world, which is so far from the model, your thinking is kind of straight. The task of the rabbis throughout the ages has been to take the ideal, the model, and make it workable in this world. And that's not by the conservative route of compromising the model. That isn't necessary to do. It's not a question of compromising the model, it's a question of adapting it in a way that makes it functionable, it makes it workable. The important thing about the Gemara is that it was its unanimity. In the Gemara itself, there are a lot of divergent views that are recorded. But at the end of the period of the Gemara, in around 600, about 600, all the rabbis of that time signed it off as being an accurate and complete version of every view and divergent view and differing opinion that existed up until that time. So what we've got to realize that what we have at the Gemara is, after thorough debate that went on hundreds of years over every word of the Tanakh and every word of the Mishnah, we have every view that was ever expressed up until the year 600. Now anybody working in those fields knows that we haven't had greater brains than those. We've had different brains, we've had different ideas. So in the Orthodox view, from that time onwards, we've had developments and interpretations, but nobody would go back and express a view that doesn't exist in the Gemara. How you work these views together, how you weight these different views, how you apply these different views, how you deal with conflicts between the views, how you take a modern problem and understand the principle in the views and apply the principle to a modern problem. That's what all post-Gemara literature has been about. But nobody would take a view and say, you know, all the rabbis up till the year 600 were wrong. I've got a new approach that they didn't think of. Nobody would have the chutzpah to do that. And that's where the line is drawn between conservative and orthodox. And therefore we say, yes, men are fallible and so on, but this was so unanimous among such divergent brains. And don't forget that the Gemara, the Talmud, was being debated simultaneously and without communication in Babylon and Israel. And we have two Gemaras. So when we talk about the Gemara, we're actually talking about two different Gemaras, the Yerushalmi and the Bavli. Two completely different records of debates that were taking place. And they're virtually parallel. There's very little difference that comes out between them. But when we talk about the Gemara, we're talking about the inclusive, the whole lot. So for somebody now to come along and say he's thought of something that they didn't think of, it just wouldn't fly. Nobody would take that very seriously. It's just not academic. It just doesn't hold up. All that we're left to be able to do is work with the material that they've given us, because that now becomes the total body of basic Jewish knowledge. And since then, of course, we've developed a whole lot of Jewish knowledge that has developed that has applied that has refined that has given different angles to it, but not that is divergent from it, not that is different from it. So if we draw that line between conservative and orthodox, that would be the point of withdrawing. The degree to which we regard the Gemara as the authority, both in methodology, in the way we think, and in the constellation of the full range of divergent views that we can work with when we look at a problem. Within orthodoxy, now, and modern orthodoxy, I don't mean modern orthodoxy in the conventional sense, I'm talking about orthodoxy in the modern times, interesting things have happened. People came out of the shtetl kind of environment into an American environment. Mm-hmm. Two approaches. This is great, let's work with it. And oh my goodness, how are we going to survive this? Those are the two approaches. Anyone can understand that, coming out of an environment where you couldn't go far wrong. You could lust as much as you want and you could do this, because at the end of the day you were working in a fairly controlled sort of environment. You couldn't go too far wrong. What you wanted was probably kosher. In every sense of the world, because you were working in that kind of controlled society. That doesn't mean that things didn't go wrong in those societies. Things went horribly wrong in those societies, but they were far more controlled than anything that we have today. Out of that into the big wide world, America. And here you had the beginning of these two divergent approaches. The one approach being, well, let me throw in one other element into it, and that's the yeshiva itself. Let's go back to the time of Reb Chaim Volozhiner, the founder of the yeshiva movement, the disciple of the Vilna Gaon in the 18th century, who started the first great yeshiva in Volozhin. Not long after he started it, the Russian government wanted to insist that Russian be taught as a subject in the yeshiva. There was debate among the alternative was to close the yeshiva. There was debate among the rabbis of the time, not just in Volozhin, but throughout the world, and quite bitter debate. A lot of them felt, so what, so we'll teach Russian. If that's the way, we'll keep the yeshiva open, not the end of the world, they'll learn Russian and yeshiva. The other view was no. The moment we allow a source of teaching other than the Torah's way of thinking in the yeshiva, they're not saying people shouldn't learn Russian, go to university to learn Russian, go to college to learn Russian, but if we allow teachers to enter the walls of the yeshiva who have a viewpoint of life different to the Torah's, then our one pure source of education gets adulterated. And you can't say, well, they're only learning Russian. A teacher teaches life, no matter what he's teaching. When a teacher walks into a classroom, he has an opportunity to teach thinking, to teach an approach to things. It's not just mathematics or justice or just that. A teacher has an amazing opportunity to influence, and the feeling was that there needs to be one place where there's only one system of reasoning working, and that's the Gemaras. So the traditional approach there was, in a yeshiva, nothing but Torah. Many people left yeshivas and went to colleges, went to universities, went into business, did whatever they wanted to do, but not, that was never admitted into the yeshiva. The yeshiva boys were discouraged from even reading stuff that wasn't Torah. You want to read, read when you finished yeshiva. When you've got your own philosophy clear, read whatever you want and you'll know how to deal with it. But don't bring it into the yeshiva. The yeshiva has to be a place where you can, where a boy can know he comes and he will be bombarded on all sides with nothing but the millions of varieties of Torah thinking, but nothing that isn't Torah thinking. That was the thinking that in the yeshiva movement. Come to America, and now think 1945, 1946, 1947. What are we going to do? Say yeshivas only. So you had two views. You had Rav Aaron Kotler of Lakewood, and you had Rav Yosher Ben Soloveitchik of the Brisket system. Now the Briskets epitomized purity. No secular in yeshivas, no. And the Briskets are the absolute epitome of total non-adulterated Torah thought inside the yeshiva system. Rav Yosher Ben Soloveitchik took a divergent view and said, we're not going to make it if we do that. We've got to get to modern people, we've got to get to contemporary people, and the only way we're going to do that is by merging them in a yeshiva environment. And so he backed and played a part in creating Yeshiva University, which was the beginning of the modern Orthodox movement, for which his cousins, who respected him enormously as probably the greatest Talmudic scholar of our age, right, the Rabbi Yosher Ben Soloveitchik of New York, who died only a few years ago, was considered even by his biggest opponents as the master of Talmudic thinking. That we haven't, since the war, we haven't had anybody like him. But they wouldn't speak to him. They respected him, but they wouldn't speak to him. Because they considered this a complete abandonment of their approach to bring secular into religious. The Baron Kotler followed the same view and said, no ways, not in our yeshiva. So Lakewood and its yeshiva movement continued with this purity. When you're in yeshiva, it's only yeshiva. Out of that came these two movements, modern Orthodox, which took Rabbi Soloveitchik's idea and moved further and further left with it, and said, well, if we can incorporate this, we can incorporate all sorts of other things, to the point today where at Yeshiva University you've got a gay club.
Come on.
Yes, you do, you have a gay club, it's legitimized. Now why? Two reasons why. The one reason why is because it's been government funded, it's funded by the public. There's certain things you can't do if you're taking government funds. You can't, there's certain things that are not constitutional, and not this, not that, and there's nothing much they can do about it. And the other view is, people just do their own things. It's not, we're here to teach, we're not here to impose. And the students can do their own stuff. We're not going to teach homosexuality. We're teaching Torah, and we're teaching the various different things, and people must make up their own minds. So you've got then the opening for modern Orthodoxy to do as it will, and to create a very wide range that there is today of modern Orthodoxy, from very authentic, uncompromising Torah with a modern flavor to quite far to the bordering on the conservative side.
What's the Rabbi Soloveitchik think of this? He must have seen it if he died recently.
He must have seen it happening. Yeah, he wasn't too happy with it.
And it was only because they collected public funds.
Well, it's collecting public funds and an environment of a whole approach of people must make up their own minds, and we're not here to impose.
That wasn't his intent. It doesn't sound like that was his intent.
That might not have been his intent. I'm not saying it's justified, or I'm just saying that's as far as it went.
No, but it just took off.
It took off on that thing, and his cousin's views was that that was inevitable. Huh. 50 years ago, they would say, we were telling him that you can't control it. Once you admit foreign sources into a yeshiva, you can no longer control the yeshiva. At the end of the yeshiva has to be a place. It's like introducing art school into MIT. It's a different discipline, it's a different way of thinking. You can have any science at MIT, but don't bring the arts in. You want to go to FIT and you can have any art, but don't bring mathematicians in. They'll ruin it. There's a certain way of thinking that you want to permeate an institution. And if you bring in a way of thinking which is very different, you create conflicts with which you won't be able to handle later on.
Children's schools, which is just full of all kinds of teachers teaching them all kinds of junk.
Yeah, so there's some views that isn't okay. So in the extreme right, you won't have. The teachers are very much controlled what they can and can't teach and what subjects they can and you can't. This gives a very wide perspective of what's available. Now we're dealing with a big world out there. Let's then take it further. The religious view, the right wing, has gone further and further into contraction. As they've seen what's happened to modern Orthodoxy, they keep on saying, oh, you see what happens? Let's move a little bit more to the right. And as modern Orthodoxy has moved a little bit more to the left, so they've moved a little bit more to the right, thinking that's the only way to protect themselves. Is you see what happens when you come into any kind of contact with all these different views and all these different ideas. The next thing you've got homosexuality in the yeshivas, and oh, you're a terrible thing, and we're going to move off to the right, and that then becomes their issue. So you've got an enormous polarization. Originally the polarization was conservative and reform on the one side and Orthodox on the other side. Now within Orthodoxy you've got enormous polarization, with modern Orthodoxy moving to the left and Orthodoxy, traditional Orthodoxy, moving to the right, and young people making choices, and the choices is either much more to the left or much more to the right. And you've got now parents whose children have abandoned them in a sense, moving either much more to the left or to the right of where they felt very comfortable. But where they felt comfortable is not where people are choosing to be right now, which is creating a problem all of its own. It's neither Rambam nor the Rambam.
What had they decided back in the Belarusian issue, though? Did they allow the Russians
to talk? They didn't. They decided rather to close the yeshiva, and they got eventually the Russians back down. The decision was no yeshiva, then we have to open a university and teach Talmud in the university. But we're not going to allow Russian in the yeshiva. Their decision was, and they were able to reopen it shortly afterwards, and they were able to negotiate an understanding that they would not teach Russian.
I mean, you're talking about two different institutions, but is there anything of an institutional stature in the middle?
Okay, so now my argument is that you cannot have an institutional thing in the middle. You can have individuals in the middle, but you cannot have institutionalism in the middle. Let's have a look at it. Absolutely, the moment you start institutionalizing Judaism, that's the one thing that the Torah never allowed. Where do we have what kind of? In fact, even the founding of the Lozhin, the Vilna Gaon opposed in the beginning, because it was institutionalizing yeshivas. What was a yeshiva before Volozhin? When I said Reb Chaim Volozhin started yeshivas, that was 200 years ago. What were the learning institutions before that? And what was a yeshiva? Yeshiva was a rabbi of a town who gathered some students around him. And they went home at night, and they came in the morning, and they studied with him.
But he had a lot of students before they died.
He had a lot of students, but not in a yeshiva as such. It wasn't in a structured yeshiva. The moment we start putting these structures in place that create yeshivas and a modern Orthodox movement, and the Muslim movement was opposed by the very same briskers. The moment there's a word movement attached to it, danger signal. Because now you've got to start defining what does the movement believe in. Who cares what the movement believes in? You've got a Torah and you've got an individual. Now figure out what's right for the individual using the Torah, and it might be very different. So I might have to say, Karen, your sons, they shouldn't be learning Russian. Really not a good thing for them, or English, or anything. They should just be learning. They should just be learning Torah. And Joanne, your children, if you're just not going to expose them to that, how are they going to be able to communicate in the world in which they're operating? Of course, they need to be. Now, put those two children in the same institution. You can't. So now we're going to say, if I'm the founder of an institution, I'm going to say my institution doesn't teach Russian, or does teach Russian, and whoever wants to join it joins, and whoever doesn't. And now I've got a whole group of people saying, but one second, if your institution teaches English or mathematics or whatever it is, then you're not part of the traditional Orthodox Jewish world. So you better define where you are. Well, then I'm part of modern Orthodoxy. So now I've created an institution which has found its place, but you're starting to move off. So yes, I do say that once you get into institutionalism, you're automatically creating a situation that is incompatible with the true Torah. And that's the real challenge that we face, is moving beyond institutionalism and being able to understand and being able to work out what is right for each individual. And in the same family you can have two children who need something very different. And how do you create yet a family that has one value system, that believes in one thing, although it allows for this child to go that way and for that child to go that way, and yet they're being driven by the same belief and the same force? Our Torah is the only system that allows that, and we're wrecking it. We're adopting from other religions and other ways of thinking the boxing institutionalism, which is the very thing that Torah allows us not to have to do. It allows us to look at the Ramban and for the Ramban himself to say to his own congregants, but this isn't for you. It allows us to look at an argument that took place much earlier between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, you remember, was the guy who lived in a cave for many years, and where they argue in the Gemara. Here you've got an example of two divergent views. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai says, if you allow people to go to business, or in those days farming, they plant in the winter, whatever it is, and they this in the spring, in the spring, and this in the fall, and this in the summer. They're busy all the time. When are they going to learn? So forget it. Do study, learn, and God will provide. And you've got Rabbi Akiva saying, but it says in the Shema, the Asafta de Ganecha, you will go and gather your wheat. That means nobody else will do it for you. God's not saying, I will gather your wheat. He says, the Asafta de Ganecha, you must go and gather it. I will not do it for you. So we've got to allow people to do it. And the Gemara says, so who's right? This is a major question. Do you go to business or don't you? Do you study and God will provide, or do you go and do it yourself? And the Gemara just makes an interesting comment and says, many have tried Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai's way of withdrawing and have failed. Many have tried Rabbi Akiva's way and have succeeded. What's the Gemara saying with that? Why doesn't it just say the law is like Rabbi Akiva? The Gemara is telling us the ideal is like Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. You should be on such a spiritual level that God takes care of you. The fact is most people aren't. And if you aren't, then for you the ideal is Rabbi Akiva. It's not a question of black and white and right and wrong. Some things are, but some things aren't. And one has to be able to allow for that without compartmentalizing. And that's the essence. Where the difficulty starts with Hasidim and Misnagdim and modern Orthodox, and this is when I am right and you are wrong. That's where you start wrecking it. Not I am right for me, but you might be right for you. But maybe for your child, I am right. And maybe for my child, you are right. Maybe I want my child to go to your school, but your child should come to my school, because those are those particular kids and how they are. It's not an understanding and a weighing up of the enormous diversity of opinion that the Torah allows us within legitimacy. Instead, it's the institutionalizing, and the moment there's an institutionalizing, there's a requirement to exclude any view outside of the institutional boxing. And that's what we're coping with, and that's what we're dealing with. We're going to have to leave it here today. I've got to... got to get back to Lot and some of his conflicts and problems, which we'll do next week. Just briefly, are there any questions on that before I close up?
Okay. You're supposed to educate each child according to their needs, and you know, learnings. So, and we have no choice but to send them to institutions.
Yep. Well, we do have choices, but we choose to send them to institutions.
Well, I mean, practically speaking.
No, don't say we have to. Once you start saying we have to, then you abandon responsibility. You can teach them yourself at home. You can teach them, turn them to a non-Jewish school and hire a rabbi for them. There are other options, but we choose to do what everybody else is doing. So it's okay. That's what we've chosen to do, but let's not say we have to.
So we've chosen to do this. So if you have two kids who are very, very different, is it a bad idea to send them to different schools knowing that they would be getting input, and would that be a recipe for creating conflict at home?
Tension, not conflict. Mm-hmm. We'll create tension at home, and that's beautiful. Imagine a boring home without tension. Conflict you don't want, but out of tension comes discussion, comes debate, comes sharing of ideas, comes divergence. Tension is what you do want, provided you can resolve it. Which now becomes, that's why it's so important for a father to be able to learn. By being able to learn, I don't mean that he can read and translate. I mean to be able to think so that he can, and a mother, can guide the development, the bringing of all that together, and create an environment where you can get these divergent opinions. And sure, provided that can be handled, so the question comes, but what happens if I can't handle it? Then I rather delegate to an institution. Then I better send all my children to one institution so that I won't have the tensions at home, which I can't cope with. And so people then decide, well, let's just decide what school do I feel most comfortable with, and that's the line that I'll send my children to. But ideally, no, we should be able to manage those tensions and to explain to each the shortcomings of their own line that they're going to, and allow the children to be able to debate that and to be able to see it from different sides and why one is good for one and one is good for another. That's certainly one has to be able to do. I'm certainly going to have that in my home. As Bruria is going down her kind of line, it's very different to where Livy is going. And it's very interesting to hear them talk, and sometimes the talking gets quite heated.
How did that, at what age, I mean, I know some people send kids to certain institutions because they have deficit disorders or this or that, but for a normal, intelligent child, let's say all things being equal, at what point do you know, I mean, how do you decide which way it's really the child's way, not your, you know?
Now you can tell very early, you can sometimes tell before kindergarten, but that's not always easy, and sometimes it develops as you see. Certain things you can tell very, very early, and other things develop as you move on. But it becomes an important decision towards high school. That's when it really becomes an important decision. where they start developing a peer group that they're going to take with them, probably through life. So that peer group now becomes the important issue. And you can have one year where a particular school has a particular peer group that you like, and the next year the same school has multiple peer group. And although you might want to send a child, you might have wanted to send the second child to the same kind of thing that the first child is, that school doesn't offer the same kind of thing. Doesn't mean because the school was good last year, it's good this year. Different teachers, different kids, different, and one really should have the bigness to be able to evaluate each for each child. And yes, that does cause confusion for people, and they can't understand quite, you know, who are you and what are you? Are you Modern Orthodox or are you Yeshivish? And if you're Modern Orthodox, why is your child going into this Yeshiva? And if you're Yeshivish, why is your other child going into that? And they get very confused, and so they do. But they're operating in an institutional framework. And it's a lonely route to go. I was only half joking when I said all these different things on me, because what's not because I'm the only person who holds this, not at all. But I'm saying those are all institutions, and I'm not willing to become part or to make my children necessarily become part, all of them, of one just because that's the one I feel comfortable in. There's a lot more to it than that. And within each one there are all sorts of institutions. You can start breaking it down to the point where it becomes absurd. And one has to make a choice whether one wants to go the institutional route or one wants to go the individual route. Once you've made that choice, then all sorts of other things flow. But the first thing a person should confront is individual or institution. That affects the way you learn, who you learn with, how you deal with issues and dilemmas, how you deal with school issues. Until a person, I don't believe most Jewish people make that decision. They just sort of find themselves somewhere or another. That's the first decision to confront is, do I want the comfort of being in a box where all my friends are in the same box? And then I can sort of relax and we know where we're going. Or do I want the challenge of constantly making decisions, constantly making choices? Do I want to confront that variety of choice that the Chinuch spoke about and said it's those choices, it's not a one-off choice, but once in my life I decide I'm going to become religious. And what kind of religious? I'm going to become Rabbi Lapin religious, or I'm going to become Yeshivish, or I'm going to become this. And then I've made my choice. Now I can sit back and off we go. But that's not what it means. It's a constant looking at issues and saying, what's right for me today? What's right for my children today? And to make sure that while I'm making these choices day by day, there's still an integrity to them. They all still fit in with one philosophy, although they don't fit into one box. That's the challenge and that's the difficulties of it all. But we'll have to follow that up with discussions next week.